in Perek Hey, chapter 5, and I'm hoping to wrap up the chapter today. I think it's doable. Last time round, we saw Hiram, king of Tsor, and Shlomo HaMelech make some kind of an arrangement between them. We introduced it by talking about who Tyre in general is, and they are this peaceful and secure nation that lives up north. That's where they were at the end of, as recorded at the end of Sefer Shoftim. They were allies of David HaMelech, of King David. Hiram builds the palace for David. And Hiram, in the version that we have in Malachim, reaches out to Shlomo. Commentators deal with the fact that in Divrei Hayamim it's different. But they suggest that he wants to perpetuate the relationship he had with David with Shlomo. I see someone requesting live transcription be enabled. I'm going to allow it for now, but if it becomes a distraction for people, then you should know you are able to disable this transcript appearing on your screen. You click more and then click hide subtitle and you can get rid of it, which is exactly what I'm doing right now for myself, because I just find it as a distraction. Okay, so Hiram reached out to Shlomo to perpetuate the relationship he had with David, and he was very impressed with Shlomo. We talked about last time what exactly it was that impressed him, and the sentence that we're up to is Perek Hey, chapter 5, Pasuk Chaf Vav, sentence 26. In which we are told, "Vayhi shalom bein Hiram uvein Shlomo." There was peace between Hiram and Shlomo. "Vayechasu v'ris shneihem," and they made a covenant, the two of them. So I didn't want to go into this in great depth, but I did want to mention it a little bit. If you look at source number one on your sheet, I referenced an article from an early volume of the journal Tchumen, Rabbi Yigal Ariel, "Habrit im Tzor." The covenant with Tyre, where he discusses some of these, some of the issues involved in making such a covenant. The first question is, are you allowed to make a brit with Tsor? Are you allowed to make a covenant with Tyre? And I gave you references in source number two. We're not going to look up the verses, but you can if you wish. We're not going to look them up right now, but the first one says, "Lo sichros lahem v'leloihem bris." When you come into the land, you're not supposed to make a covenant with the residents of the land. Second one, "Hishamar lacha pentichros bris liyoshvei haaretz." Be careful not to make such a covenant with the residents of the land. And finally, "Lo sichros lahem bris v'lo sichanem." Don't make a covenant with them. Do not show them favor. So how are you making a deal with Tsor? So one resolution is to suggest they are not of the seven Canaanite nations. Even though, as I think I mentioned last time, Tsor and Sidon go together, and Sidon is the firstborn of Canaan, nonetheless, they are not of those seven tribes that live along the Jordan. And maybe the prohibition against making the pact is only with them. We know they're not mentioned. When the Torah lists the seven nations, it never lists Tsor and Sidon. That's one approach. Another approach that I've seen suggested is that the people of Tsor and Sidon are not idolaters. When you look at Hiram's speech to Shlomo, he talks about Hashem selecting Shlomo and he blesses Hashem. They're not idolaters and maybe therefore it's okay. Why does Shlomo want a covenant with Tsor? So the convenient and simple conventional answer is the obvious, which is they are a powerful neighbor, they're a wealthy neighbor, they're a neighbor who you want to be on good terms with in terms of trade. So obviously, you know, you make a pact if you have the opportunity. Rabbi Yitzhak Levy floats a very, very interesting alternative idea. Take a look, please, at source number 3 on your sheet. In his article, Malchut Shlomo B'Yerushalayim, part 3, he says, "Tchuna nosefet shel Tsor hi ha-kosmopolitiyut shela." He says, an added trait of Tyre is their cosmopolitan nature. Heyota rochelet ha'amim, described in Yechezkel as peddler to the nations. This is a good statement. This is not an insult. Peddler to the nations. They're the merchants. Mikumashal tzor l'chov hayamatichon, their place on the Mediterranean shore. Hafach ota l'mokad bin le'umi l'schar u'letarbut. Because of their location, they are an international locus of trade and culture, as I translated it here. Kimoforat b'hemshech otoperek, as is spelled out in that chapter in Yechezkel. In that sense, they become a microcosm of all of the nations. Tyre represents the world as a whole. V'shitufa b'binyan ha-mikdash, and the fact that they join in for the building of the mikdash, mevaser ulay et chazon ha-nevi'im, The fact that they join in with the construction of the Beis HaMikdash heralds the fulfillment of a prophetic vision that in the future all the nations will recognize God and they will come for judgment in Jerusalem. So, yeah, well, I don't need to say it in other words, because he's about to say it in other words. Lashon Acher, Botat Kufahi Tatsor Hatsinor Hamatin Lekasherat Haolam Kulo Lebinyan Hamikdash. Tyre is the way to connect the entire world with construction of the Beis Hamikdash. Ubevoha Eis Apla Gil Hamikdash Ulakir B'malchus Hashem, and at the right time to actually arrive at the Beis Hamikdash and to recognize the reign of God. I would add an idea here, in addition to what Rabbi Levy writes, which is, he seems to say, since Tyre is the merchant to the world, it's like the whole world is involved in building the Beis HaMikdash. But when you have a port like that, where everybody trades, you actually physically have representatives of the nations of the world. There's a reason why New York becomes New York. Right? When you have that kind of a place for international commerce, you get all different kinds showing up there as part of the population and supporting them, this idea of Rabbi Levy. You've involved the nations in the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, which is Shlomo's vision. So that would explain on an added level why he wants a covenant with Tyre. Again, I wouldn't leave the simple, straightforward reason he wants a covenant with them, which is it's convenient. They have access to everything. You want to be on good terms with them. But also, as a religious vision for the Beis HaMikdash, for the temple, I think that's interesting in its own right. But here's a question. Why are we telling this story at all? Meaning, my focus, if you ask me what you need to know in this set of chapters, I need to know about Shlomo's character. I need to know about the blessings God gives Shlomo, right? I need to know that he's building a Beis HaMikdash. Do I need to know who his wood supplier is? Like, why are you giving me all this information about Hiram? Just tell me, Shlomo brought in cedars from Lebanon and move on. So I see people starting to answer, but I'm going to give an answer, and I'll take questions and comments afterwards. I think on one level, it shows us that utopian world we've been describing in Shlomo's day. We talked about how it was utopian in terms of territorial expansion, in terms of peace, in terms of wealth, each one with his grapevine and his fig tree. Another way is having the nations come to us and make treaties. And specifically, as it's recorded in Malachim, Hiram shows up first. It's Hiram, you know, volunteering, wanting to make a treaty with us. So I think that is a reason why you'd want to record this. It's another example of how everything is wonderful at this stage. Second approach from Radak. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, he says, Tam Hasipur. You see it? You know, the person who requested the transcript isn't on anymore, so I think I'm gonna get rid of the transcript in case it's annoying anybody. Okay? Okay. Disable. There we go. So, if you take a look at source number 4, Tam Hasipur Hazeh, the reason for this story, Hinei ki berov habinyanim asher bana nir asa chochmaso. In the great many buildings, I originally translated as most, but that I was just writing too quickly. In the great many buildings, right, like Lerov Echav with Mordechai, the great many buildings that Shlomo built, you can see his wisdom. Kmo she'amar b'malkat Sheva, like the Queen of Sheba, v'tera malkat Sheva et kol chochmat Shlomo, v'habayit asher bana. She saw the wisdom of Shlomo, the house that he built. So what we're really doing here is showing Shlomo's wisdom in his management of the construction. And this is a manifestation of that wisdom, making a pact with Hiram. So that's a second. Third, the combined texts of Malachim and Divrei Hayamim show Shlomo's wisdom in his negotiations and his generosity with Hiram. I talked about this a little bit last week as we read the verses, but take a look at Abarbanel, please, in source number 5. Because it's a longer source, I'm just going to read out my English translation. Solomon increased, hirba, asking for something hard to find, so that Hiram could not fulfill his request. And this is a comment based on the text, not that we read in Malachim, but in Divrei Hayamim, where Shlomo asks for a craftsman who's an expert in gold and silver and this and that and the other thing. So he says, yeah, Shlomo is deliberately asking for something that's hard to provide. Therefore, he, Hiram, would agree regarding the cedars. Ask him for something he can't give you, along with something he can, and he'll say yes for the thing he can. The practice of the wise is to ask a lot, so that they will at least give them a little, which is what they wanted in the first place. Also, Hiram, in his good heart, agreed to all of Solomon's requests and did not reject any of his words. He actually delivered on everything. And therefore, the prophet only recorded in Malachim the goal of the request and Solomon's intent, right, which was just for the cedar wood. And in Divrei Hayamim, Ezra saw fit to record the entire request. That which was necessary, the cedar, and that which was not necessary, the craftsman who's an expert in everything, to display the wisdom of Solomon and Hiram's love for him in his response. What emerges from this entire story is to relate Solomon's efforts and his generosity in what he did with Hiram of Tyre to bring cedar wood and cypress wood from his land via his servants, and the gift he gave him annually of wheat and oil to feed his house. Solomon comes off as generous in the way that he provides for Hiram. All of this was to acquire laborers who were suitable for the work as needed for the stature of the building. So that's the way Abarbanel reads it, is sort of building on Radak's idea. Radak had said, you're demonstrating Shlomo's management of the construction. Abarbanel says you're showing his wisdom and his generosity in his negotiations as well. Rav Amnon Bazak comes to the same conclusion with a very creative read of the negotiations. And I gave you some bullet points in source number 6. I didn't want to bring and translate the entire thing. He says, if you read carefully, Shlomo's initial offer is just to provide wages for the laborers. That's it. He's not paying for the wood. And he's going to send his men as well, and they're going to watch and they'll learn and they'll receive training at the same time. Hiram praises the wisdom of Shlomo and says, Baruch Hashem, blessed is God, but thank you very much, my men will do all the work. And that way, I mean, it means they'll get paid more, but also Shlomo should provide food for his table, the wheat and oil annually. So Hiram, this is very Middle East, right? It's a very Middle East negotiation. Shlomo puts out one offer. Hiram says, oh, you're wonderful, you're amazing, but my men will do all the work and you're going to feed my table. Right? That's the idea. Parenthetically, Radak thinks the feeding was only done during the work, but Abarbanel thinks it was even afterwards that this was supposed to continue. Rav Bazak also notes that this arrangement of having Shlomo provide grain and oil makes sense. Because back in those days, Sor was actually an island. I didn't look this up. Rabbi Zak makes the contention, and it's the sort of contention that you only make if you have support for it. Tyre was an island at this point. It's Alexander the Great who comes along and connects it to the mainland by having his men backfill the space in between. I know nothing about this. Sounds good to me. I don't know. Vanessa's shaking her head. I don't know if that's, really? Anyone can Google it. I just didn't do so. But if they're really an island, then it makes sense that they would benefit from somebody providing the food. They have to bring in whatever they want, by boat. So Shlomo hears this request from Hiram, and he says, no, I am sending in my guys to participate, which thereby abbreviates the task and abbreviates the period for which he needs to feed Hiram's house, if you believe, as Radak does, that ends when the task ends. So it's a back and forth bargaining that's going on. So Rabbi Zak says, in Divra Hayamim, we skip the whole bargaining phase. It's only included in Malachim in order to show Shlomo's wisdom. Divra Hayamim, on the other hand, brings in a whole other piece, which we didn't see here, in which Shlomo tells Hiram about the theological importance of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple. You don't see that here. It's in Divra Hayamim. So again, right now we have three explanations for why we're telling this story about how Shlomo got wood. The utopian vision, the nations come to us and make treaties. Shlomo's management of the construction shows the wisdom God gave him. Or we're seeing his wisdom and his generosity in his negotiations with Hiram. But there's a fourth approach. Don't worry, Rose, I see your hand. You can put it down, I'll still see it. The fourth approach takes things very differently. And this is my own, but I think there's a lot to be said for it. I feel like this whole covenant with Hiram is a warning of problems that are coming for Shlomo. Because the relationship with Tsor, with Tyre, and with Sidon doesn't end well for either us or them. Tsor, Sidon, are a corrupted version of us. Look at the sheet, please. Source number 7. I didn't bring you translations here. You don't need it in order to see what I'm showing you. Of course, you're welcome to look them up in your Tanakh. Take a look at source number 7. The first two verses there are from Yeshaya. The first verse is talking about Sidon. Remember, those of you who did Yeshaya with me, remember how chapters 13 to 23 or so, to 26 I should say, you get 10 different enemies of the Jews and visions about them? So look at what he says there in the opening line. You no longer will rejoice. Lo tosifi od la'aloz hama'ushaka bitulat bat Sidon. You see that? The bitula, daughter of Sidon. Which will remind you probably of the next line in which the Jews are described as bitulat bat Sion. They are bitulat bat Sidon, a bitula, a young girl. They are the Bitula, daughter of Sidon. We are the young girl, the daughter of Sion. And in both cases, it's used specifically in a rebuke. It's used to describe their downfall. We get called that not just here. It shows up in Malachim. It shows up in Eicha. But that's one example of how they are sort of a corrupted version of us. Look at another example. This I didn't notice myself. I don't remember anymore who I saw comment on this. It might have been Rabbi Zak or Rabbi Levi. I'm not sure. Take a look at the third and fourth verses here in source number 7. The third one, Yechezkel. God says to Yechezkel, go tell Tzor, so says God. At Amart, you said, Ani Kelilat Yofi. I am a crown of beauty, you said of yourself. And the Jews themselves, I have it said of them, if you take a look at the fourth line, this is from Eicha, Hazos ha'ir sheyomru klilat yofi. Is this the city that they called a crown of beauty? The same term is used to describe the Jews as to describe Tsor and Sidon. And then the last part of source number 7, Yechezkel chapter 28, in which Yechezkel is told to wail for the king of Tsor. And look at the part that I bolded. Malei Chochmah, they were filled with wisdom. Uklil Yofi, the crown of beauty, once again. Be'eden Gan Elokim Hayisa. You were in Gan Eden, the garden of God. This is talking to Chiram of Tsor. Kol Even Yekaram Mesuchasecha. You had every precious gem sheltering you. And then look at the list of gems that I bolded. Odem, Pitida, Yahalom, Tarshish, Shoam, Yashfei, Sapir, Nofech, Bareket, as well as Zahav. What does that list remind you of? Yes, Hannah?
The Choshen.
The Choshen. These are gems that appear on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, right? You have almost the entire list there. You've got 9 out of 12 on this list that they have. I see your hand, Ricky, but I'm going to ask you to hold off, even though it's directly relevant.
Yahalom is not a diamond. I didn't call it a diamond.
These are all gems that appear on the Choshen. I'm not going into the question of what their names are in English. So these are the materials that are used for the Choshen in the Mishkan and then in the Beis Hamikdash. They are the gems of Tsor, of Tyre, which is described as having the Garden of Eden. They are a version of us, is what I'm trying to say. The beauty, the betulat, bat zion, sidon, the klilat yofi, the gems, and they are criticized for becoming arrogant. And if you take a look at source number 8, you get Yechezkel chapter 28 once again, in which he talks about how they became so great, and then they became haughty, and they became arrogant, and they saw themselves as above. The Midrashim do a ton with this, about them becoming arrogant. And Chiram being in Olam Haba in the Garden of Eden, there's so much that goes on there. I just wanted to bring you one midrash about it in source number 9. The Gemara in Bava Basra, commenting on the verse that we saw at the end of source number 7. What is the meaning of the, you can look at it with the dots if you want, in source number 7. It's right after the part that I bolded, the last bolding there. Malachas tupecha unikavecha bach, which we translate as the work of your settings and your holes was in you. Tupecha, like the setting for a gem. Nekev, a hole. So Amar of Yehuda Amarav, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Chiram Melech Tzor. God said to Chiram, king of Tyre, bach nistakalti, I looked at you, Ubarasi nekavim nekavim ba'adam, and that's why I created holes in human beings. What does that mean? He's talking about it the same way that we describe holes in the Bracha v'Asher Yatzar, meaning for excretion. Hashem says, I looked at you and I felt the need to take you down a peg. And therefore, I gave you this animalistic type of process of excretion. And then, Ve'ika di'amri, alternate version of it, still in source number 9, Hachi ki'amar, this is what he said, Bach nistakalti, I looked at you, the kanasti misa al adam harishon, and that's why I decreed that human beings should be mortal. Because it's not good, they become arrogant if they live long. So the point here is, they become arrogant, that's the depiction in Yechezkel, that's the depiction in the Gemara on the psukim, the verses in Yechezkel. And eventually they come to harm us, directly and indirectly. First of all, take a look at source number 10, please. This is talking about King Ahav, Ahab. Right? Ahab, how did you meet your wife? Source number 10. Vehi hanakel lechto bechatos Yeravam ben Nevat. It was a nothing for him to follow the sins of Yeravam ben Nevat. Yeravam was the one who led the 10 tribes to split off from the south, and who built temples for idolatry and so on. Ahav follows those ways. Vayikach isha, and he got married. Es Izebel bas es Baal melech Tzidonim. He marries Jezebel, the daughter of Etbal, who is the king of Sidon, and then he went and he served the Baal himself. He served the Avodah Zarah, the idolatry. Izebel imported idolatry into Israel. So Sidon leads us astray. That's the point. Sor and Sidon lead the Jews astray. They not only lead us astray, but they turn traitor against us as well. If you take a look at source number 11, the verse in Yechezkel, Ben Adam, this Ben Adam is the way God addresses Yechezkel. Yan Asher Amarat Sor Al Yerushalayim Heach, because Tyre said of Jerusalem, Heach. Ha'ach is like a rallying for them against us. Nishbarad al sos ha'amim nasabo elai imol ha'chareva. Because they attacked Jerusalem, therefore, they actually egged on the destruction, therefore they're going to be punished. And the prophets describe them as traitors to us. If you take a look at source number 12 from Yoel, where God says to Tzor and Sidon, do you think you are paying me something by harming the Jews? Do you think I'm happy that you're doing it? And then finally, the last line in source number 12, when Amos criticizes each of the nations, his criticism of Tzor is, Al hihasgiram galus shlema le'edom. They sent us completely into exile in Edom, Velo zachru bris achim, and they did not remember the covenant of the brothers. Many commentators say that refers to the covenant with Shlomo. So what you're seeing here, and what I'm trying to show you, is the relationship right now looks very, very good. Right? It's all lovey-dovey right now. Shlomo, Hiram, best buddies. But it's gonna go bad. They're very much like us, until they are not like us at all, and they cause harm. The last piece of that, and then I'm going to take comments and questions. I know I've been talking for a long time. But the last piece on that, take a look at source number 13, a really striking line. The Gemara there is talking about why the second temple fell, the second Beis HaMikdash. And you're familiar with the idea that it's sinas chinam, it's baseless hatred. The Gemara in Yuma deals with this and gives different explanations. And Reish Lakish says it's because the Jews stayed in Babylon. They didn't come back to Israel when they could have. That's Reish Lakish's position. And Rabbi Yochanan says, no, that's not what it was about. Ki asa l'kamed Rabbi Yochanan, when Reish Lakish came to Rabbi Yochanan, Amar le, he said to him, lav hainu time. He says, that's not why. Inami saliku kulhu bimei Ezra. If all the Jews had come to Israel for the Beis HaMikdash in the time of Ezra, lo ha'bashar yashchina b'mikdasheni, God would still not have been manifest in the second temple. Why? Because the verse says, Yaft Elokim liyafet v'yishkon be'ohalei shem. The bracha that Noach gives to his kids, he says God should expand Yafet, and he will dwell in the tents of Shem. He is God. In this read, Hashem will dwell in the tents of Shem, meaning, Alpha Gav Yaft Elokim Liyafes, even though God will expand Yafet, Ein Hashchina Shora Ela Be'ohale Shem, the Shechina will only be manifest in the tent of Shem, and since the tent was built with the help of Tzor, who is from Cham actually, not even from Yafet, right, they're from Canaan, because of that, therefore, the Shechina will not be manifest and the temple will be destroyed. So the fact that you partnered with Tzor is actually destructive. That's really the key point in this Gemara. It's worth noting that in the Gemara in Megillah on Daf Tes, Rabbi Yochanan reads the same sentence differently. Rabbi Yochanan reads it there as in a more familiar way. God should expand Yafet, and Yefet should dwell in the tents of Shem, and he uses that to explain why it's okay to write holy texts in Greek. So there, the opposite. He actually redeems Yefet there, but here he reads it this way. So again, summing up, we're telling the story of the covenant between Shlomo and Hiram. It shows us perhaps a utopian world. Nations are coming to us and making treaties. Maybe because Shlomo's management of the construction shows the wisdom Hashem gave him. Maybe because the negotiations and his generosity with Hiram are meant to show us his wisdom and his greatness. Or it's a warning. Problems are coming for Shlomo and the Beis HaMikdash. This is actually a problematic covenant, a problematic relationship. Okay, thank you everyone for waiting. Rose, you were first.
So, you know, there's a difference between wisdom and shrewd. And to me, this is just shrewd. Shrewd business, because there's no wisdom in any of this. The guy just worked it out, he calculated it, and that was it. And the other guy was also shrewd, because
Like I said to you when we were talking about the different words that are used in the Hebrew for Shlomo's wisdom and understanding, chachma, bina, da, whatever it is, I'm not sitting here trying to differentiate between types of brains. Yeah. So don't pick up on wisdom versus shrewd. It's just a convenient translation for the word. That's all. Sandra.
Okay. What is the timeline when Sigon turned on Israel? Was it when Yerubam took the northern Shvatim, or did it go a little bit past that?
That's a really good question. The problem is that we only get retrospective information, meaning the criticisms that we see in, like I brought in number 12, in Yoel and Amos, don't give us enough information to figure out when that took place. Yechezkel talks about it in the context of the Churban, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which of course is far later. So it's really, really unclear. It would be interesting if, when the Northern Kingdom split off, they said, well, our covenant was with Shlomo. We don't like the fact that the Northern Kingdom split off, and therefore we're going to attack them. That would have been very interesting. But it seems not, because they're involved in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash itself. So that wouldn't be so. But we don't have enough information. If you go on YU Torah, to my shiurim on Yoel and Amos, You'll see there, it's very unclear when this is referring to, except that Yechezkel links it, as I said, to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. That's really all the information we have.
Thank you.
Dahlia.
Do you see any parallels with all the agreements we're making with other countries today?
So I never know what to do with that. That question comes up from time to time. The problem is that the issue of when it's good and when it's bad to make deals is extremely unclear. Sometimes they make deals in Tanakh and they get criticized for it, right? When we learned Yeshaya, we saw Yeshaya criticize king after king for wanting to get support against the Assyrian invasion. And you know, Yehoshaphat is told not to seek alliances, and others are told not to seek alliances. At the same time, David had alliances, and he doesn't seem to get criticized for it. And he's not the only one. I mean, David, I know, has a certain immunity to certain criticisms. But in general, it's very, very unclear where it's okay and where it's not okay. Clearly, where it's an attempt to thwart God. God says, I'm bringing punishment. And instead of doing tshuva, you say, well, I'm going to go get myself a big ally to support me. That's not good. That much we can figure out. But it's it really is unclear. As a matter of fact, when we learned Yeshaya, we saw a vision at one point that in the future, Egypt, Assyria, and Israel will be united in the service of Hashem. So at some point there is a treaty. They're not becoming us. They're joining with us. So yeah, unclear to me. Bruria, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was just wondering, was Shlomo held responsible for what happened with Tyre? Did he know, did he have any hints that this was going to happen?
Hey, look, he's the smartest of all men. If anybody's going to know, it's going to be him. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is he held responsible for doing this? Was it something that he did that it was considered that it wasn't a good thing?
So we don't find that, except this Gemara itself. Right? The Gemara itself is saying that's where things started to go wrong. We also saw, when we talked about his marriage to Bat Paro, that is considered to be the root of things going wrong. So
right.
We do find criticism of his unions with other nations. Yes, you do find that. Okay. Dahlia, yeah, and then we're going to go forward.
I sort of, you know, depending on how you read the sentences about his wisdom, which are in the beginning of this Beric, and he had this wisdom and that wisdom, I can also see it as, you know, a built-in criticism. He had all this wisdom, and yet he made some arrogant mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't make deals that would be really in the best interest of us without, you know, educating the other nations. And look at him. He had all this wisdom, and yet this is what he did.
So
that's how I read it.
So we're going to get to his downfall eventually. Right now, all we're getting are hints of it, like in the previous discussion that we had about his horses. We're getting little bits and pieces, but we're not getting enough information. We don't have a complete picture yet. And in terms of the nations, I think he is trying to educate. Like, there's a big emphasis coming up in, and we already saw some of it in this chapter, on the way that he's winning respect of the nations around him. I'm not so sure. Okay, there's more. There's a lot more to see here. So let's talk Livanon. If you see, well, it's on the sheet, but chapter 5, sentence 20. Okay, Perek Hei, Pasuk Chaf. Ve'atat Saveh v'yechresuli arazim min ha-Livanon. Shlomo says to Hiram, tell them to cut cedars for me from the Livanon. So, this note that I'm going to give you on Livanon isn't really about Shlomo. It's just something brief that I thought was important to note in terms of the evolution of the word Livanon. Originally, and in most of Tanakh, Livanon is a geographic location way up north, right? If you take a look at source number 14, I gave you a couple of references here. Just its use as a boundary marker for the land. So in the beginning of Sefer Devarim, the Jews are told to leave Har Sinai, to come to Har HaEmori and to all of its neighbors, Arava, the mountain, the Shvelah, the Negev, the Chof HaYam, Eretz HaKenani, the land of the Canaanites, VeHaLevanon, and the Livanon. The second one also, later on in Devarim, Parshas Ekev, I think, Min Hamidbar v'Halavanon, from the wilderness and the Livanon, Min Anahar Nahar Prat, from the Euphrates, Vayama Acharon, to the Mediterranean, that will be your boundary. So it's a geographic place, and it's a place associated with cedar trees, right? The according to Wikipedia, source of all wisdom, the cedar found in Lebanon has yellow, fine-grain wood. And I wonder if that isn't associated, the yellow, you know, kind of pale color, with Livanon, Lavan. There actually is something called white cedar, but it's native to North America. It wouldn't have been their cedar. Nor does it look white, but that's a whole other discussion. The Livanon term comes to be used for the Beis HaMikdash itself. And there's already basis for seeing that prophesized in Chumash, the last line of source number 14, where Moshe says to God, I want to cross the Jordan. Eberana, I'm going to cross. Ve'ares, Aretz HaTova, and I want to see this beautiful land, Asher Be'ever HaYarden, which is across the Jordan. Ha'har HaTov HaZeh VeHaLevanon, this great mountain and Livanon. If that Livanon really means some place up north, why is Moshe specifying that's what he wants to see? Like Moshe says, I want to cross the Jordan so I can see Lebanon. That doesn't make any sense. So already Midrashim pick up on the idea that Livanon there is something special, and we associate it with the Beis HaMikdash. First of all, because the cedars of Lebanon are used to build the Beis HaMikdash. Ralbag also contends, and I brought it for you on the sheet, source number 15, Hebrews on, no, I didn't translate it. Oops. Okay, just Hebrew. He says, Hayazah binyan, okay, so I need to actually explain it. I need to explain it. We're gonna see, God willing, in chapter 7, that Hiram doesn't only build a Beis HaMikdash for Shlomo, he also builds a palace for Shlomo, and he also builds what's called the Beit Ya'ar Levanon, the house of the forest of Lebanon. I actually referenced this last time, I think. So take a look at source number 15, where he tells you what this house of the forest of Lebanon was. It was a place where Shlomo could cool off in the sunny season. Remember, Barbanel talked about Shlomo traveling to different places? So this was a place for Shlomo to be in the summer. And presumably, he had a lot of entrances for it, right, for ventilation. And I would think, Sheyar Levanon Haya Karov LeBeis HaMikdash. I think it was probably near the temple. Ulazen Nikra LeBeis HaMikdash Levanon. And therefore, the Beit HaMikdash gets called Levanon. So it's in this Ya'ar Levanon, which is near the temple. In other words, separate from Lebanon up north. There is a forest near the Beis HaMikdash called Levanon, and there are commentators who actually believe that that's where Hiram was supposed to bring the wood from. Not up north, but actually from this forest. Some actually make that argument. But the point is that you have a Levanon right near the Beis HaMikdash, according to some commentators, and that would be another reason why that name is associated with the Beis HaMikdash. One is using cedars from Lebanon. The other, though, would be if there actually is a Lebanon forest. But either way, because the term Levanon is used for the Beis HaMikdash, it becomes a biblical term for Jews altogether. So take a look at source number 16. This is from Hosea. Three verses in a row in chapter 14. That fateful chapter, right? That's Shabbat Shuvah, the Shabbos before Yom Kippur. It's read as the Haftorah. So Hashem says, I will be like dew for Israel. They will flower like the Shoshana, and they will strike roots like the Levanon. And then it continues. That their young plants will go forth, their beauty will be like the olive, and they will have a scent like the Levanon. And they will sit in the shade, and they will have grain, and they will flower like the grape, and when they are recalled, it will be like the Levanon. Three different times there, and it's talking about us. And then in the second temple period, Hosea's first temple, second temple period, Zechariah uses it a lot. He talks about us. He described Levanon falling into destruction, and he's talking about us. I gave you his verses from chapters 10 and 11, and then I gave you in source number 17, Abarbanel. Commenting on it as well. I realize that I don't have time to get to everything I want, so I'm going to skip reading that aloud. But I want to show you that rabbinically, the association of Levanon with the Beis HaMikdash becomes very strong. Source number 18, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the sage, is talking to Vespasian, the Roman general. Right? You remember this story? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wants the Jews to make peace with the Romans. He doesn't want the Romans to destroy Yerushalayim. He gets himself smuggled out to this general, and he greets the general as though he is a king. He calls him king. And Vespasian says, you're in trouble now. I'm not the king. And his response to Vespasian is, oh, yes, you are. Take a look at number 18. He says, Ivra Malkaat, but you are king. If you weren't the king, Jerusalem would not be handed over to you. Dichsiv, because the text says, V'halavanon ba'adir yipol, the Levanon will fall to the mighty. Now, in context, that's a verse in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, where it's actually talking about the Assyrians. It's not talking about that. It's about the Assyrians. Nonetheless, he is talking about us. Levanon, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple will fall to the mighty. And when it says the mighty, Adir, that's a reference to the king. And Levanon, he says, is the temple, is the Beis HaMikdash. Shenemar ha'hara tov hazeh v'halevanon. He points to Moshe's verse. He said, I want to see the Levanon. He says, that is the Beis HaMikdash. So what you're seeing here is a use of Levanon to refer to the Beis HaMikdash, and then in source number 19, the Gemara in Yuma, where I'm only going to bring you one piece of it, it talks about the Beis HaMikdash knowing that it is going to be destroyed, and it is called Levanon there by Zechariah, and Rabbi Yitzchak ben Tavlai asks, why is it called Levanon? From the word lavan, white, shemalbin avonosehen shel Yisrael, because it whitens the sins of Israel, meaning it cleanses the sins of Israel. So, upshot of this, and then I'll take questions and comments, and I know I went through it a little quickly, I apologize. It's just not the main focus of our learning, but I didn't want to go without it. And what we're seeing here is Livanon, where we get the wood, could be Lebanon up north. There are those who contend it's a forest actually close to the site of the temple of the Beis HaMikdash, which would explain, by the way, why Shlomo isn't paying for the wood. It's actually our wood, if you take that approach. But more relevant for us is the fact that Levanon becomes a name for the Beis HaMikdash, especially in the Second Temple period, and it becomes a name for the Jews as a whole. Clear? Somewhat clear? I got some somewhats. Questions and comments. Yeah, Rose.
Is this where there's a criticism of Rabbi who met with a Roman? Am I right? Is that a pasuk that they criticize him because they say he's like a chamberlain, you shouldn't negotiate, or am I completely wrong?
So there were two camps in Jerusalem at the time. There were the zealots, who said that you have to fight, and the rabbi said you should not fight the Romans. And the way it's presented in the Gemara is that the zealots are horribly destructive. They burn down storehouses in order to force them to stop waiting out the siege and to fight. The zealots don't come off very well in that retelling. Yeah.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thank you.
Questions and comments besides? Yeah, Janine.
Sorry, I missed part of it. I had some rumors coming in that was beyond my control. But first of all, it sounds like Lebanon is a different country. I've been trying to look. I'm learning Yoshua with grandson, and I'm having a lot of trouble understanding the geography. But it sounds like Lebanon might be a different country, not Canaanite, maybe Plishtim. And I think that was why they didn't acquire it right away because they were not able to get the cities of the Philistines.
So the Levanon, first of all, we said last time that Sor and Sidon are at war with the Plishtim, with the Philistines. They don't like the Philistines at all.
Unless those are the people that took over or something. There's something of the island of Crete, maybe?
No, the Philistines are from Crete. It's believed that they're from Crete originally. That's true, but they're completely different from Tsor and Sidon. They're not they're not on the same page. Just in terms of the geography in Yoshua, it might be helpful if you can find my recordings on it on YU Torah, because we actually did it going through it with Google Maps, trying to find where things are. So that might be worth catching. But in terms of
Tsor and Sidon, these were supposed to be part of the boundaries of Eretz Israel, right?
So that's a very, very interesting question in its own right. Very unclear. When you have the story in Shoftim, chapter 17 and 18, in which Dan takes the land up north, they take it from Sidon. There's a debate in the commentators as to whether that was land that was originally supposed to be theirs from Israel, or whether that was actually outside of Israel and they were taking it. Yeah, very unclear. The commentators disagree with each other on it. Take a look at Shoftim chapter 17 and you'll see, actually 18. 17 is the build up to it. Yeah. Sandra, and then Chana.
Are those
a
Prushim or
is it Sadukim? The zealots are neither. They're Biryonim.
Biryonim?
Yeah, Biryonim is what they're called. They're not part of the Prushit, Stuki discussion. it's a different thing. Uh-huh. Yeah. Chana?
It looks clear that the wood came from the non-Tzion, not from the Yartzion, which is close to the Mikdash. Pasuk Chav Gimel says that...
They put it on rafts.
With what?
You're talking about the rafts?
Yeah. They
yeah.
By the sea, so...
Yeah, I don't see any... I don't really see a way to support the view that the wood is local. The only advantage of that view is that then you understand why Shlomo is not paying for it. But I think it's a difficult view to sustain. Yeah. Okay. So, I'm going to go further. I apologize. I see another hand, but my computer is warning me that it's going to die, and I don't have a power cord here, so I want to see what I can get in. Racing to see if we can make it to 2:30. So, who is doing the work on this Beis HaMikdash? We have competing records, and if you want a headache, you can really explore this, but I thought I would spare you the headache. We're not going to explore all of it. It's really tough. Take a look, though, at source number 20, where I referenced the different sets of verses. You have our chapter 5, sentences 27 and 28, which says, Vayal HaMelech Shlomo Mas Mikol Yisrael. Shlomo collected a tariff or a tax from all Israel. Vayi Amas Shloshim Elef Ish. What was the tax? 30,000 men. Vayishlachei Levanon. Now he sent them to Levanon. Aseres Elefim Bachodesh Chalifos. 10,000 per monthly shift. Chodeshu Balevanon, they would spend 1 month in Levanon, Shnayim Chodeshim Bebeiso, 2 months at home, Va'adoni Ram al Hamas, and there's this figure, Adoni Ram, who's in charge of the Mas. We get to him later on in Malachim, possibly. So, the first version of this is that Shlomo presses the Jews into labor to build the Beis HaMikdash. Radak makes the comment in source number 21 that kings can do that. If you go back to Shmuel, right, Shmuel Aleph, Perek Chet, you remember that Shmuel warns the nation of what the kings can do. And there's a classic debate. Most commentators on the text, in the biblical text, say he's talking about powers that a king doesn't really have legally, but they're going to do anyway. Whereas there's a view in the Gemara that, no, this actually is the power of the king. But either way, what does he say? V'atem tihyu lo la'avadim. You are going to be slaves to the king. So, that's what's going to happen. He's going to take them to work. That's one read. That's one version of what happens in the story, but as we're about to see, it is not the only version of what happens in the story. If you were to look in Divrei HaYamim 1, chapter 22, and in Divrei HaYamim 2, chapter 2, you would find there that David, in his day, gathered Gerim. Gerim, we usually think of as converts, but that's not what we mean here, to do the work for the Beis HaMikdash, and Shlomo used them for this purpose. Who are these Gerim? Ralbag and Abarbanel say it's people we've seen off and on in Tanakh. We met them in Yehoshua, we saw them again in Shmuel. Take a look at source number 22. Visiper, Bidivre Hayamim. The text says in Divre Hayamim, She'ela Kulam Achotzvim Va'Nosim Hayu Gerim. The people who did the wood chopping, the people who did the mining, were Gerim. V'yidmeh She'hayu Meha Giv'onim. These were the Giv'onim, the Gibeonites, the ones who in Yehoshua tricked the Jews into making a treaty with them when they weren't supposed to, and then ended up wood choppers and water drawers for the Mishkan. Those people, that's who we're talking about. Lomi Gerei Atzedek Asher B'Yisrael. These aren't Gerim, these aren't converts. These are foreigners who live there. Ki Agivonim Nisyashvu B'Soch B'nei Yisrael. They were from outside of the Jewish people, but they lived with us. Vayiteno Sam Yoshua Chotvei Eitzim B'Shovei Mayim L'Beis Hashem. Yoshua made them woodchoppers and water drawers for the house of God. As mentioned in Yoshua, V'Shaul HaMelech, Olav HaShalom, Hishmidam, Shaul, I should say, excuse me, Shaul destroyed them, Mehisyatzei v'chol gvul Yisrael, he wouldn't allow them to live within our borders. Ve'alzeh meisu shiva b'nei Shaul, and Shaul loses 7 descendants as a result. That's a very difficult story in its own right, there's a lot to be said about that. One day we can do Shmuel Bet, and we can discuss that. But he's Abarbanel is presenting the view that Shaul actually aggressively attacked the Givonim. Ve'az Shavua Givonim Lityashay Be'eretz Yisrael. But after Shaul's family was punished, the Givonim returned to live in Israel. Olafi Shahayu Chayavim Lachtov Eitzim B'lishov Mayim LeBeit Hashem. And since their job was to chop wood and to draw water for the house of God, so they said, oh, I guess that means we should be involved in doing this work, and they willingly accepted it. That's Ralbag's read, that's Abarbanel's read. So who's doing the work, the wood chopping and the mining? The Givonim. But then you have version number three. Version number three, my last bullet point in source number 20, is found in our own book, in Malachim, in chapter 9, as well as in Divrei Yamim Bet, chapter 8, and that is the work was done by Canaanites, who remained in the land. So who did what? Two approaches, Rashi and Radak. Rashi, commenting on chapter 5, sentence 27, says the mas, that tax, was not a tax of labor. We had to provide work. Rather, it was a financial tax we had to pay for 30,000 laborers. That's the way that he reads it. Radak does not like that at all. He says, then how do you explain the monthly shifts? It doesn't sound like this at all. He doesn't like that idea. Radak says, there were different kinds of work. There was easier work, and there was harder work. Some of it was given to the Jews to do, and some of it was given to the others, the Givonim, the Canaanites, whatever it was. Separate note: there's a problem of competing numbers in these records for how many laborers there were, how many people supervised it. But I'm not going there at all. I did want to note two danger signs that are going on here. But my computer is giving me the last dire warnings of battery running low, and it's going to cut out on me. So we'll start with that, God willing, next time. The warning signs that are involved here. We also have summary questions for chapter 5, and then, God willing, next week we'll launch into chapter 6 before getting the Pesach break. Okay? Thank you very much, everyone. Have a good week.
Thank you.
Be well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.